Hello, everybody. We're back from Vegas. Today, I'm sitting down with Harris Bassett of Bitdeer, CTO over there, for the second time to talk all about their SealMiner and Bitdeer in general. Enjoy the show. All right. Like I said in the brief introduction, I have the pleasure again to be sitting down with Harris. Hello, Harris. How are you?
Hey, Jesse. I'm doing great.
How are you feeling after Vegas?
Still a little tired, but I've been traveling a lot. I think you and I have seen each other in a couple of different locations over the last few weeks in the Middle East and again in Vegas, right?
And now we can also say that we have attended a wedding together.
Oh, right. Yes, absolutely.
That was fun. Lots of fun stuff there. The jet lag, honestly, ripped me, to be honest. And I have kind of, I think I'm going to try and do less of these big events, mainly because it's just so busy, almost too busy. The mining section, I thought, in the event, I don't know if you had a chance to see that. I know you were on stage as well, multiple times, I think. Very packed. Great to see the vendors there. Great to see how much variety there is. And of course, for somebody like me who's into business development and making connections, that's a honeypot, right? I know you guys had a booth there as well. What was the main goal for you guys with the booth? Do you know?
Well, I didn't spend much time at our booth. I was mostly in private meetings with potential customers and partners. But I think, we were highlighting our SealMiner products and talking to people who were interested in that.
Yeah. That's what we're going to chat today about as well. Just want to note, we are recording at 899. No worries. Yeah. 899-801. And fees are very low. And still, mempool is very empty. Hash price is at 5273. And estimated difficulty adjustment coming in at -3.21. Do you look at hash price more or less than a year ago, Harris, would you say?
Well, for me, I think about the same. There's not much difference. I don't look at it that often, which you might find surprising for a miner. But, there are a lot of other people at Bitdeer that look at it much more frequently than I do.
Yeah, especially now that you guys are also selling your ASICs, as a revenue, an additional revenue stream now that you're somewhat more independent of hash price. Do the miner prices go up and down with hash price, or are they not affected by that?
The demand for mining rigs has fluctuated with Bitcoin price, just recently, like this. When it went up and then down and then up again. So we have noticed that. And of course, we've responded to it. And, we price competitively. So pricing of miners does, get affected by that as well.
Okay. All right. Just before we get into the weeds, can you give listeners again, if they haven't heard the first chat we've had, just a 30,000 foot view of Bitdeer? And briefly say what you guys are really good at and what you are less good at.
Okay. So, Bitdeer is one of the largest mining companies in the world. We have worldwide 2.7 gigawatts of power. We're using a little over 1 gigawatt right now, and we're developing the rest very rapidly. We're going to have several hundred more megawatts up this year. And we're rapidly expanding our self-mining capacity from just single-digit exahash to 40 exahash or more by October of this year. And we're the only fully vertically integrated mining company out there that's publicly traded. And so we are making the mining rigs. And of course, we have our own data centers and we mine for ourselves, and we also support a limited amount of hosting on top of that. So we have data centers all over the world, but mostly in the US, Norway, Bhutan, Now Alberta, Canada, and Ethiopia. Let's see. We are into AI HPC, like some of the other companies that are in Bitcoin mining. And we're in there in two different ways. One is that we have a small data center in Singapore that has GPUs that we rent out. And we also support various AI models and application development for AI. But the larger effort is to take a 570 megawatt site in Ohio and turn it into a turnkey data center and then lease it out to, you know, a hyperscaler or someone like that. So we have that effort ongoing as well. But in the Bitcoin mining space, we're one of the largest, the only vertically integrated, and we're doing the thing that's the hardest to do in Bitcoin, which is designing energy efficient chips. And I think we're the only real company in Bitcoin that's a deep technology company.
Have you ever wondered if you guys should be less vertically integrated?
Sometimes, not really about the chips. I think the chips are our strong suit. I think that's in our DNA. We really know how to do that. But there's another level of vertical integration where you own the electrical generation capacity and you're not relying on the grid. And we have just started doing that as well in one location, which is Alberta, Canada. And I did think about that along with other people in the company, but it just seemed right to do it there. Because there's plenty of expertise within Alberta on how to run such facilities, so we don't have to rely on our own expertise for that. And the natural gas price is just so cheap and so plentiful. Alberta has, you know, 10 or 15 times more natural gas than Texas. I think it's third after Saudi Arabia and Argentina in the supply of natural gas. So it's very plentiful. It's mostly stranded. We can make electricity very cheap. But, you know, it was we had to go through it thoughtfully and think about what the drawbacks to that level of vertical integration were. And in this case, we felt it was worth doing. But in terms of integrating into the chip area, I think that's key because 80% of your capital costs go to the vendor of the mining rig hardware. And if, you know, that's way too much of your business to just sort of hand off to some third party, I think.
You said 80%, 80?
Yeah, 80% of your capital budget is typically spent on the mining rigs, the other 20% on the infrastructure. 80% of the operating expense is typically electrical cost
and cost. And how much of that is margin? Now that you guys know what it costs to produce ASICs, how much would you say people over the years now have paid Bitmain's margin? Was it more like 5% or more like 50%?
I mean, I think it fluctuated between those numbers. I'm not saying what our margins are, but I'll explain. You know, it depends on whether you were buying their most efficient machine and how much demand there was at that time. You know, famously, Bitmain would charge much higher prices during the high peak demands than they did during other times. And so you could, a lot of the profit during the bull market was taken up by them. You know, so having a competitor to Bitmain is important. And I think that's part of what we're planning on doing. It's having, you know, a very substantial percentage of the market and being a good alternative to the existing the players there. And, you know, our margin is going to vary based on which machine it is and how much, you know, what our pricing is from TSMC at the time. And both of those things are getting better. Our machines are getting more efficient. The A3 is going to be the most energy efficient machine out there when it is, you know, released. Well, actually, we're going to start marketing it this month, and we're going to start shipping them in October. But it should be the most energy efficient machine out there, and that gives us a chance to price it better. And then the it's actually a very high yield, very a good low cost to manufacture. So that gives us pretty good margins, much better margins than on the A2. Most of the A2 machines went in-house anyway, but we're selling a fair number of those as well. But the amount of external sales should increase moving forward.
This episode is sponsored by Hashbranch, the easiest way to mine Bitcoin in the US. Sourcing hardware and rack space usually is a mess. Bad deal structures, misaligned incentives, and no visibility after deployment. I have placed tens of thousands of ASICs in partnership with Hashbranch. What I like most is that they cut through the noise. Fair pricing, aligned terms, and access to hosting that actually works. Use code HASHRATEUP100, visit hashbranch.com today to get $100 off of each miner that you order.
All right, so you are also going to hit the below 10 joule per terahash era. Just on the prices, I don't know if there's any other commodity that swings as wildly as sort of a beta to Bitcoin. That's why it swings so wildly. I mean, you can get S19J Pros for $250 today. And I know I paid $3,000 in 2021 and then sold it for $12,000. I mean, it was absolutely crazy, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's been not that long of a time span, I guess. And I don't know if there's anything else that compares. You already jumped into the ASICs. That's where I want to go next. I know last time we spoke, Harris, roughly a year ago, maybe a bit more, you guys were just about to release the CL01. Now you've said you are already in the third generation with the CL03 being announced this month. What have you learned from CL01 going to CL02 and then now CL03? Like, what are the improvements that you make, not just on the chip design, but overall design of the machines and surrounding process of building and selling hardware?
Well, all of the CL01 went internally. We used it internally. And I'd say the vast majority of the CL02 has gone to internal use. And that's how we are, you know, multiplying our self-mining hash rate by such a large amount over a short period by primarily the A2 machines. So, you know, we've learned a tremendous amount on the technical space and, you know, to improve the designs. We've also, you know, learned that the hydro-cooled machines tend to be, you know, the best value. And we think there'd be more focus on hydro cooling moving forward. We've learned that, you know, the firmware is something we're looking seriously at possibly doing open source firmware, you know, that really giving the market what it's asking for there. Well, we have to examine that carefully and make sure that makes sense, but that would be, you know, a way that we might go that's different than others.
Yeah. Especially because it's sort of aligned with the Bitcoin ethos a lot more. I think it would be very interesting.
Also, it's the most trustworthy thing, right? That you can do is just to open source it.
Yeah, I don't know. Something happened. I just heard rumors about this. I haven't actually looked into this. But something happened with Vinicius third-party software where they forgot to update a certificate, SSL certificate, and it caused a ton of miners to shut down. So there's risk there as well, and open source firmware would take care of some of that, right? It certainly would put the responsibility into the ASIC owner's hands and maybe give them a bit more comfort also in running their software. This leads me to a question that I had written down for later about third-party software. Do you guys, when you sell these machines, do you look for firmware to be sort of competing with dedicated third-party software out there? Or is it basically what you guys need internally and the machines just come with that? Do you expect people to install third-party firmware for sure? What's the thought process there?
I mean, I think there's two different types of customers. Some customers are very inclined to install their own firmware and, you know, some third-party software, and some are happy to use it the way it is. And so we want to, you know, cater to both types of customers. Right now, you know, we only sold a small number of these machines, you know, a few exahash. But as we sell more, you know, we will be able to say more about that. Our natural inclination is to make it easier for the customer on the software side. And exactly how we do that, we haven't really decided that yet.
What would speak against open sourcing it?
Well, open source still requires a lot of support, right, from the company. And, not really sure what the negatives would be, but we haven't thought about it long enough to, feel completely comfortable that we've given it that kind of diligence that it needs to understand that. And I think we need to talk to people in the industry and just make sure we're creating something that is of value.
I mean, there's a ton of people out there that love participating and being productive on these open source projects. And if you open sourced it, I don't think there's a limit to what people could get out of the software, which you could also apply down the line to your own ASICs, if it's deemed safe. Yeah. Who knows what people come up with. It's been pretty crazy in Bitcoin in general. All right, so the SealMiner 03, are you planning to sell more of those this time around, or also just using that in your own fleet?
So our priority is always to fill in our own capacity first. But our own capacity will, start getting filled up by the end of this year and certainly going into Q1 and Q2 of next year. So we will... And we expect that the capacity that we receive from TSMC will continue to ramp upwards. So we'll be making more machines, but yet have less capacity internally to use them. So the natural consequence of that is that we sell many more machines, especially of the A3. And the A3, as I said, it's got the best gross margins for us. It's the most competitive machine out there. And so that's a great machine for us to really focus on, a very steep ramp on external sales. As I mentioned before, we are selling the A2 externally as well.
What happens to all the A1s?
I mean, they still get used. They're good machines, and they're I can't remember exactly where we put them. I think they might be in either Rockdale or Norway.
But yeah, I don't know.
Those won't get replaced for years. Right. And the A1s, if you think about it, are less than 2 years old.
Yeah, the ASIC market just moves so quickly. And if let's say you had capacity to replace all of them with A3s and with the internal models that you have and the cost structure, it makes sense to replace all of them. I don't know, maybe it makes sense to,
As long as you have spare capacity, it probably makes more sense just to use that up first before we start replacing. And we have a lot of old machines from Bitmain and others that we, purchased long before the A1s that would get replaced before the A1s got replaced.
Okay. How do they compare, especially with the history that you have on the A1 now, the 2 years history? How do they compare on reliability and maintenance cost and stuff like that when you compare it to other models out there? From other competitors.
I mean, there are some, it looks really good, and it especially looks good for the A3. Now, the A3, we don't have thousands and thousands of wafers yet, or tens of thousands of devices to really look at that in a very sound statistical way. But from the dozens or hundreds of devices that we've seen, the initial reliability, the operation over temperature extremes, those all look really good.
The differences in the chip, Harris, just to recap that, I know we went into that the last time we spoke on the show a little bit, but at the end of the day, everybody gets their chips from TSMC, right? And then...
Some vendors use Samsung as well, but most use TSMC.
What's the percentage there? TSMC versus
very
Samsung.
Little. I think your statement was largely correct.
Okay, and you basically hand in a chip design and they print it for you, putting it in very basic terms, right? Is there anything that happens after the fact where you squeeze out extra efficiency. One thing that people often ask me is, or they talk about the physical limit in the nanometer size of these chips. Is that, I think it's the transistors. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But is there a physical limit, and how is it possible to squeeze even more? Like what part of the ASIC design do you guys focus on to get, what's the lowest hanging fruit to get to even more efficiency? And where have we reached limits that we cannot get across? I don't know, there's a lot of questions in there. I hope you can break it down.
Maybe I'll give this a little bit of an overview. So, the design is done, you know, on a computer, right? And the design teams for Bitcoin are typically 20 to 40 people. And, you know, when the design is completed, and the design is done using software from companies like Cadence or Synopsys, which are also publicly traded companies. And so the design's completed. You have this data that's, you know, fairly large files that then get transferred to a TSMC. In the distant past, that data transfer was done using a tape, which is why this is called a tape out. And so, but in modern day, of course, you just transfer it over the internet or a secure link. And then TSMC takes that data and they create masks with it. And the masks are used to do what you said, which is print the design onto silicon in layers. And that's that whole process called fabrication. Then the fully fabricated wafers are then sent to a facility that's called an OSAT facility, Outsourced Semiconductor Assembly and Test, where the wafer is diced into small pieces and packaged. And then the packaged semiconductors are sent to a printed circuit board assembly facility where they're placed on the printed circuit board, assembled, and then the PCB boards are stuck into a rig and fans and power supplies are added. So we design the whole thing. The chip, the board, pick the package, the power supply, we either design it or in some cases have a third party design it. And then the cooling systems that are used, and then the housing, everything we design, all of it. You can save some energy by doing very good power supplies and cooling. In fact, you can also throw away some of the efficiency by doing a poor job at the power supply and cooling. And Bitcoin actually uses some very interesting power techniques that are not used outside of Bitcoin right now that actually make it quite efficient. So, but the vast majority of the efficiency is really in the chip. Now, to the other thing is, you know, the different nodes, people are probably familiar with, oh, this is a you know, 6 nanometer, 5 nanometer, 4 nanometer, 3 nanometer nodes. And that measurement is referring to the gate length in a transistor. So it's one part of the transistor. And in the past, it really did refer to the physical gate length of the transistor. But perhaps at least maybe now 10 years ago, it stopped referring to that. And it's really just a marketing number. So, you know, if your last one was 5, then your next one's going to be 4 and the next one's going to be 3. Now, the gate and in the transistor does shrink with each one. So does the metal wiring. But it may not be anything related to the number that you're using. So it's more of a marketing number to indicate, oh, this is the next generation because it's a smaller number. But in the past, it referred to the actual length of the gate. And that's the thing that controls the passage of electrons from across the switch, which is the gate. So there's a source and a drain and then a gate. And that distance between the source and the drain, which is the gate, is that length that was measured. So that's down to 3 nanometers now and going to 2 nanometers. And, you know, TSMC has that available for some of its advanced customers at 2 nanometers. 2 nanometers is 20 angstroms, which is, you know, roughly 6 to 7 atomic distances, atomic, spacings. Very, very, very small. So people are saying, well, that's flattening out, and it probably is. And so that's yet another reason to look to the design of the circuit rather than the fabrication. So, you know, we have been lucky. We have from 2013 or 2014, when the first ASICs came out, to now, which is a little over 10 years, gotten close to 1,000x improvement in energy efficiency. And a lot of that energy efficiency comes from the manufacturing process at TSMC improving. And as long as you're relying on that and that alone, then, you know, you're competing mostly on, you know, on cost and not performance with the other vendors. So the thing that we control is the design. So if we can make the design much better, you know, like the charge recycling design for A4 or the excellent designs that people have done for the A3 to get that kind of energy efficiency, then you can have an advantage over your competitors, even though they're using the same process at the same foundry that you are.
HashRedUp is sponsored by solomining.de, the place to buy open source home and solo mining devices like the BitX. With about 20 watts of usage, these solo mining devices are perfect to play the lottery from home or from the office. Get 5% off with the code HashRedUp. Thanks to the legends at solomining.de for sponsoring the content.
Okay, so what I got from that is there's still space in the design. If you just wait for TSMC to get better, that also makes chips more efficient. PSUs on fans and cooling, of course, is higher hanging fruit. So again, to sum that up, that section, where would you say the lowest hanging fruits are when it comes to getting towards 5 joule per T, even less at some point? Is it the chip design? Is it just the tools that get better to chop the wood, basically?
So if where you would wait you... long enough, TSMC will give you a process where the design that you've done for 10 joules per terahash will get close to 5 or 6 joules per terahash, right? And okay. I don't think that that's, you know, plateauing out quite yet. They will, you know, if you follow the process advances, you'll probably get there just by doing that and using very similar designs to what you have today.
Okay.
So that's one way of doing it. And we're going to, of course, take advantage of TSMC's newer processes as well. But we are also doing a design change. These are orthogonal ways of addressing the issue. They're not mutually exclusive. You can do them both. And by doing the design change, we can get there much faster. And also, when we use the same process that TSMC releases, that others are at 5, we will be much lower than 5 because we have the design advantage. So this is not a race that has an end point. You know, it's a perpetual race. So once you have the advantage in design on a given node, you should always be better than your competitors.
What I wonder is, and I am looking for your thoughts on this, I'm wondering if there's at some point better ways to find more efficiency when it comes to cost than lowering the energy efficiency lower and lower and lower, right? At some point, it becomes so expensive to be more efficient that it might be better to invest the dollars elsewhere. Do you know what I mean?
You mean you're comparing like dollars per terahash to joules per terahash?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, think for instance, very banal example, right? If let's say we have super, super efficient chips, everybody is very competitive with each other, and there's maybe 5% differences. And now it costs 100x what it costs today to get sort of to the next level of efficiency to have an edge there. That money might be better invested in buying a power plant or using hydro or having multiple revenue stream sites that might be more capex. Just in another area of Bitcoin mining, the dollars might be better invested. You know what I mean?
There's already a very strong economic reason not to do that. So, like, if you think about it right now, the capital cost is dominated by the price of the mining rig, right? It's, as I mentioned before, it's about 80% of the capital cost of mining. And it's taking you anywhere from 1 year to 2 years to get that paid back. If you were to just double that cost, it might take you 2 to 4 years, right?
Mm.
And that's a very risky proposition in Bitcoin because, you know, that includes a halving cycle and things like that. So you don't want to wait 3-4 years to get your money back from the mining rig and then start making a profit. So you already have to, any new design that's more energy efficient, you can't sell it for so much more that, you know, it would hit what you said, like 100x or even in some cases 3x or 2x, depending on the efficiency difference. Because you save the energy, but you don't, you know, you don't want to, it's not that hard for the math. You can stick this in a spreadsheet and figure out exactly how much someone would be willing to pay for a more energy efficient machine.
Yeah.
And there's two ways of doing that analysis. One is you can say, hey, if I can mine Bitcoin at, say, you know, $50,000 a Bitcoin using this machine and this price of energy, if I had a machine that was much more efficient, maybe my price per Bitcoin drops to 40,000. Or maybe the vendor raises the price of the more efficient machine, so you're still mining at $50,000 yep. per Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, you might still want to use the more efficient machine, even if the cost per Bitcoin is the same, because you'll be getting far more Bitcoin with the same facilities that you have. And if you believe Bitcoin prices are going to continue to rise and you're accumulating Bitcoin rather than selling it when you get it, that's the better thing to do.
Yeah, even though then you have to put into that spreadsheet the opportunity cost. Yeah.
Yeah, you pay more per Bitcoin maybe, but you're getting more Bitcoin, and that's your actual goal to maximize the number of Bitcoin.
Okay, let's follow down the roadmap before we run out of time. So you get it going out with the A3 soon. The A4 is, I think, the final stage of the roadmap that you have announced. Is there going to be an A5?
I'm sure we'll do more chips after the A4.
Okay. And then do you have, for the A4, do you sort of have an end goal in mind of where you want to design and develop to, or do you just leave that up to chance and see what's possible?
Well, I mean, our target is to hit 5 joules per terahash for the chip. Mm-hmm. So maybe 6 joules per terahash for the mining rig or in that range. That's the target. It, you know, looks like we're going to hit that. The timing for the chip is to tape out the chip by the end of this year, which means that we'll get wafers back from TSMC in the second quarter and have, you know, assembled machines by the third quarter or late second quarter or something like that.
Super exciting. I mean, 5 joules per T is massive. And we just, I mean, Bitmain just announced their new hydro version with 9.5, I think going below 10 for the first time. I don't think they'll hold the record for too long after this interview. The tariffs, Harris, how do they impact you? Do you guys manufacture the miners in the US as well? What are your thoughts around distribution for the machines and using them in North American data centers with the tariffs in place?
So we don't currently manufacture in the US. You know, the wafers are fabricated at TSMC's facilities in Taiwan. We do the OSAT also in Taiwan. We do, you know, printed circuit board and final assembly in Vietnam and also Malaysia. However, we are planning on opening a new manufacturing site in the U.S. We haven't announced where it is yet, but you know, we're negotiating the lease on that, and we expect to, you know, potentially be doing assembly and the final manufacturing stages in the U.S. Perhaps as early as the end of this year or Q1 of next.
Okay. Talking about the roadmap again and roadblocks, have you encountered any unexpected roadblocks to getting to that 5 joule per T? Is it, and tag on question, follow-up question to that. Is it necessary to do hydro to reach that efficiency? Is air cooling just not efficient enough?
No, we can do it either with air cooling or hydro. That's not an issue. And the roadblocks are, I guess they're not unexpected. It's probably not the right way. We knew that we would have to develop our own software, our own design methodology for this, and that the existing methodologies for designing chips would not be sufficient. I guess the unexpected part is just really how difficult that has been. You know, it's like if you invent a new car, but then you realize the existing factories can't build that car, so you have to also invent a new factory. That's actually the problem that Musk ran into with the Model 3 as well. But so that's, and it turns out that inventing the factory or designing the factory is harder than designing the car. And that's sort of what we're seeing too. And we're not experts at the software that is used to design the chips. We're experts at using it, but we're not experts at developing it. And so that's a little bit of a steep learning curve for us. And, but you know, we're tackling it. It's you know, just more effort and taking longer than we expected.
Just on hydro cooling and immersion question there. Are they pretty much the same all around, like different hydro units? I know the form factor recently changed, you know, from the sort of shoebox Bitmain design to now the sort of the 2U rack design, where you can just put them and slot them into any regular rack infrastructure. Internally, with these ASICs that are hydro-cooled, is there differences in how the hydro-cooling is done, or is it pretty much just letting, you know, run cold water over hot chips and it's all the same?
I think it's very similar. And from a user's perspective, we are compatible with, you know, WatsMiner and Canaan on how these things are connected. I think the fittings, the hoses, and stuff that runs the water, those are all, I think, identical between the three vendors. I think Bitmain is different. And we're very similar, if not identical, to the same kind of hydro cooling systems that are used for AI as well. So, you know, the people who learn how to use our systems are also able to work on similar systems in AI or with the other two vendors that I mentioned. It's, you know, it's basically a cold plate, a water, you know, for a hydro-cooled ones, the water itself doesn't touch the chip. There's a metal plate that touches the chip through a thermal grease. And then the water is run through that metal plate and cools off the metal plate.
All right. When you design these, Harris, we talk a lot about joule per T, right? Efficiency when it comes to hash rate. Is that the most important metric that you optimize for? And if yes, what sort of comes after that? What's the most important metric after that? Right. Uptime, so, I mean, thermal stability, anything else?
Yeah, so there's a few things here. One is joules per terahash, right? How energy efficient is it? That's the headline number, and you know, that's the thing that everyone looks for. What's the next generation? And so it's clearly our highest priority. But you have to pay a lot of attention to the other things. And so the second one is dollars per terahash. And dollars per terahash really involves combining the effects of several things. One is, well, how fast are you running the clock, right? Because if you can clock it very fast, you'll get a lot more terahash from the same amount of silicon. So that's one thing. The other thing is, well, how much silicon area do you use? Because silicon area costs money. You know, you're paying for a wafer. And if the same number of terahash can be done from a smaller piece of the silicon, then you can save money. And the third part of that is yield. You know, how many chips or what percentage of chips are actually working? Because if you have a yield of 95%, then you're taking a 5% cost hit. If you have a yield of 50 or 45%, then you're doubling your cost because you have to throw away half your chips. So yield, die area, or the size of the silicon, and the clock rate at which you can clock it. Those three combined together will give you your dollars per terahash. on a cost basis. Then of course you can price it above that, hopefully. And then the last thing, but it's really very important, and it goes into total cost of ownership, is initial quality. You know, you ship 10,000 machines, how many of those come up and run right off the bat out of the box, right? Reliability, you know, how long do they last, how much replacements you have to have. And we're seeing really good results internally and from some of our initial customers. And then finally, robustness over temperature changes, humidity changes, things like that. So, and we're looking at making sure we are top of class in all of those areas.
Are you still selling your hard-mined Bitcoin for expenses like mining hardware, electricity bills, and tax invoices? With Firefish, you can access liquidity in fiat or stablecoins without selling your Bitcoin. Firefish is a peer-to-peer marketplace for non-custodial, Bitcoin-backed loans. No credit checks and no monthly payments. Sign up on Firefish today, create a loan request, deposit BTC into a multisig, get funded by an investor, and repay at the end of the term. Collateral is always at least 2x the loan. So if BTC drops by 50%, you may be liquidated. So be sure at any time to top up the collateral as needed. Thanks to the legends at Firefish for sponsoring the show. Use HashRateUp for a 30% discount on the fees and get your first Bitcoin-backed loan today.
Yeah, that's, I guess, the holy grail, right? Is having the most efficient machine in a build quality chassis and overall design that beats out MicroBT, so you guys can become the go-to miner for Africa. Because currently, you know, WattsMiner is topping the charts there when it comes to running live like beasts.
They make a good mining rig, and it has reasonable reliability.
What happens with A2 machines that are not working and that are bought by customers? Do they go back? Do you have repair centers somewhere spread out strategically? What's the strategy there if you sell more of these?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to check with the sales. We are planning on partnering with people and having our own repair centers so that we can have, a way of doing that. And for very large clients, we might even license them to do warrantied repairs. But we're looking into that as well.
And distribution, again, maybe question for the sales team. Do you sell the rigs to, you know, resellers that then go lower quantity? Can anybody come to you with an MOQ of one and get a machine? How does that work?
I do think we're willing to sell to people on very small volumes because that's sort of just I think that's really Jihan, our founder's, view on this is that we don't want to discriminate against large or small, even individuals. So there is that. The distribution channels, I'm not aware of what we're doing right now. I mean, it's handled by the sales folks. And,
gotcha.
You know, right now, I think almost all of our sales are direct.
I have to ask one more question on the ASIC design, Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys use any AI to design the chips? Do you use any, I don't know, AI within the machine to run it better when it's plugged in? Is this a factor at all, or are you just sort of sticking to the tried and tested methods?
Yeah, you know, AI is coming into play in many, many different areas. So some of the software that's used to design chips has AI components in it now. And, you know, we're using some of that. It's sort of very utilitarian, and so there's some of that. There's we're looking at using AI more in not the A4, but subsequent generations for the design part of it. We're looking at using AI for better control of the data center as a whole, you know, to manage the data center as opposed to just managing individual devices. And I'm sure, you know, AI will play a bigger role in different aspects of this. I know that the companies that sell the chip design software are looking at incorporating AI to a much higher level.
Yeah, I mean, how does that work, right? Because what data is there available for the AI to learn if everybody wants to keep their secrets. I'm pretty sure you guys are not going to release your ASIC chip design to the world and say, here, learn from this and tell everybody else how to build better chips, right? Do you think that's going to work?
No, I mean, it wouldn't, at least not now and not in the immediate future, do, you know, like a whole chip like that. It'll do a piece of it. Like, for example, if you're looking at layout of individual cells, NVIDIA published a paper a while ago that was, that they do chip design too, of course, and for standard cell layout where you have, you know, the small blocks of 10, 20 transistors at a time, that optimizing that layout, that they did that using, AI and an internal tool. And that's something that's interesting to us as well. So AI can be used to this reinforcement learning where the AI can train itself without having to have tons of outside training data. So if you have a good cost function where you can measure the result, right? So for example, let's say you do a layout and you care about its performance and its area, and you can measure those after the fact. You can just have this thing do designs. There'll be really bad designs at first, and it'll just keep learning and learning and learning. And you know, maybe it's doing 1,000 designs an hour or 10,000 designs an hour or whatever, but it's teaching itself, and you don't need to, you know, take 10,000 existing designs or 100,000 existing designs and feed it. It will just make bad designs that get slightly better, that get slightly better, and eventually much better. That's how, this AI systems taught themselves games like AlphaGo and chess, all from scratch, right? Nobody taught them anything or trained them on previous chess games. The best ones just taught themselves and played against themselves to get better.
I think at some point, though, just to pull on that string for a bit, I think if you have an AI sort of run into a direction and it has no outside influence to self-correct, it sort of keeps running into one direction. And once you release the chip design into the wild, you might find that it doesn't work at all because it lacks these outside factors. If you guys have a team, I know you guys at BITIA put together a killer team to design these chips with tons of experience, tons of culture, and different perspectives, different history, and all of that plays into it.
Yeah. Just to be clear, because we're not using, works. Yeah, just to be clear, we're not using AI for that to do the design. It's very, it takes a lot of mental energy to do the design for the A4. You need very special people with very special skill set. And I'm not talking about having an AI take at that high level of a role. I'm talking about small tasks, which are already done by software. But to replace that software with more AI-imbued software.
Yeah, the time-consuming stuff.
Yeah, the stuff that you can't do manually anyway. Like, here's a million components, assemble them in an optimum way on the chip. You're not going to find a human that can do that in a reasonable time or with any quality. It's already done by software, and maybe that software could be a little bit better if it were had some AI components to it.
All right, Harris, we're out of time. Is there anything that I didn't ask but you wish I had?
No, I think that was good.
Cool,
thank you for your time.
Perfect. Harris, thank you for your time. I don't know when the next time will be that we see each other.
I'll get a chance to visit you in South Africa.
Yes, you're always welcome. I'm at the end of the world. There's lots of jet lag, except for going north. But it's fully worth it. I can only recommend coming here and having a look. Harris, again, thank you so much for your time. I think the people know where to find you. I'll put everything in the show notes. And again, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.